Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the Opel Commercial Vehicles range. We have your van. Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now, last week we spoke about the artist Tracy Emin and her decision not to seek out the help of her friends and family when she was diagnosed with cancer and told that she might not live to see Christmas. And it's fair to say that hundreds of you got in touch with us, agreeing and disagreeing with the position taken by Tracy Emin and also sharing your own stories of difficult diagnoses and terminal illnesses. Well, it was suggested at that time that we should have a panel of people with experience of cancer to talk about how they had dealt with it. So that's what we're doing today. And I'm joined now by Robbie Connell, who's here in studio. Hi, Robbie. Brenda Drum and Elma Walsh also with us. Good morning to you both on the line.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I suppose what the aim of this really is to help people through what is a really difficult time, because we spoke about how different people deal with bad news in different ways. And I want to talk to you both about how, all of you, about how you coped, firstly, with getting that news, that diagnosis. Emma, I'm going to come to you because people will remember your son, Donal, who sadly died from cancer. But I want to talk to you about when and how you first received the first diagnosis for Donal.
Donal was 12 years old. It was 2008, so you're going back... 2012, sorry, so you're going back a bit. And initially he got pain, so he was in bad pain in his leg, and it wasn't going away, so we went to doctors and different things, and, you know, we were told initially that it was fluid in the knee and various things, and then we went to the hospital here in Tralee, and from there on, really, we were kind of drip-fed information that it mightn't be good news, you know? So we were kind of bracing ourselves for it. And when the news came then, it was just to tell him, and the one thing that Donal wanted was to be honest with him all the time. So it was just to tell him that when they told us the news, Finbar was in Dingle, and I phoned him and he came in, and we sat down with Donal and we explained it to him in as much as you could to a 12-year-old, mm-hmm. because we didn't have the experience of cancer in the family or anything like that. So in as much as we could, we told him what to expect and what we knew of what to expect.
See, that's really important for people to hear, because with Robbie and Brenda, we'll hear in a moment, they get their information about their own health from the doctors. But for you, you have big decisions to make before you get to the point where your child knows what's happening. And that faces a lot of people. But you seem to have arrived at the decision pretty quickly, Elma, that Donal would know what you knew.
Yeah, well, he was 12, so he was very aware of how we'd be feeling around the house, you know. If we got bad news and didn't tell him, obviously we'd be sad, so he'd pick up on that. And the only thing that you could do really was be realistic and be honest with him. And I think once you're honest and once you've nothing to hide then, so you're not hiding anything, and they don't feel that you're picking up on hiding anything either. Mm-hmm. And then just to reassure him, just to reassure them that you'll be with them every step of the way, and you'll be there for that. Obviously, you can't go through it for them, but that you'll be there with them while they're going through it, and you won't leave them alone at any stage. Mm-hmm. And just to give them space as well to get their head around it. You know, it takes us a long time to get our head around it, and they need space as well to get their head around it as well in their way.
Mm-hmm. And Robbie, to come to you on that, on, you know, getting that news, can you just take your mind back to when you were told and what it was like?
Yeah, certainly. We had gone through all the tests and all, and the day was November the 7th, so it's just over a year ago. And we went up to see the consultant, Mr. Richard Power, and he would be used to dealing with this. So he kind of know, he sat us down, and the first thing he said was, we need to talk about your results. Now, I would think that I would be very resilient, and we all kind of have an idea how you would deal if you got bad news. But if Arsalan was with me, who's my wife, if she had asked me what my name was right at that moment, I wouldn't have been able to tell her what my name was.
Knocked for six.
Now, my normal way of dealing with bad situations is to make a joke or to make a laugh or thing, but it was just the mist or the fog just descended, and that didn't lift for a long time. Mm-hmm. But the initial chat about I couldn't tell you what the consultant told me that day. Just when he said, we need to talk about your results, that's the bad news.
So did you feel then, before anybody else was told, that you needed a bit of time just to get your head around it yourself, or did you tell the rest of your family?
I suppose I made a decision before when we first initially went for the tests and we'd done the biopsies and that I was going to be completely open about this, and this was going to be my little hobby for a while. Now, if I got good results, that was going to be the end of it, but I would still be proactive with it. So everybody, family and all, knew that there was results coming on a certain day. So at the time of the, I kind of look back and say I shouldn't have done it, because if I had had a few days to get my own head around it, it would have made it a lot easier to explain it to everybody else. Mm-hmm.
I know you were worried about telling your mother, weren't you, because your dad died when he was very young.
Yeah, my dad died of cancer at the same age I got diagnosed. So I knew the impact my diagnosis was going to have on my mother. And it did.
He was only 52.
He was 52.
So young.
Myself and Arshan made the decision that when we came from the consultants that she was going to be the first person that we told. Just, I suppose, the way it is now with social media and kids, our kids are all adult kids now as well, you know, you don't want to see it on Facebook or Instagram, some bad news like that. So we went and told her first. And then we got the kids together and explained it to them what it was. Now, I think looking back, I would have said I was positive at the time, but I wasn't. I know that the mist was there. It was only in the last months that I could actually say that the mist has kind of started lifting.
The last couple of months?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Brenda, I want to ask about your own experience of your diagnosis. This was 2007 for you, is that right?
Yeah, it was January 2007, and I had been in hospital for about a week at that stage having tests because I had been presented to A&E with a sudden kidney failure and nobody knew why. And I happened to be on my own the morning that the results came. I had said to my consultant, look, just come in. Don't come in and say, can you get somebody here to be here with you, your husband? I just said, look, when you have the results, just come and tell me. So I had an amount of time on my own with the consultant just to absorb the news that I was diagnosed with an incurable cancer. And to say the bottom falls out of your world at that point is a complete understatement. And I remember asking her three questions. I said, is it hereditary? Will I lose my hair? And is there a cure for it? Mm-hmm. And then I had a few minutes just to kind of process it. And then I had to make the phone call. The first phone call was to my husband. And I couldn't say, can you come out? I have bad news. I had to just tell him over the phone that I had been given this really serious diagnosis of a really rare cancer that neither of us had ever heard of, that no one in my family had heard of. And we really just didn't. You couldn't really see 10 minutes in front of you at that stage, even though all this other stuff was rushing through your brain, like, gosh, am I going to be around? And I was very conscious at that moment. It was January and I had been admitted to hospital on the 2nd of January. All the Christmas decorations were still up at home. And at that moment, I had this really bizarre thought that I better label all the boxes because they'll never know where to put all the Christmas decorations next year.
That's the mammy coming out.
It's the mammy thing. And at that moment, I was thinking, what about school runs? And I have to tell her and I have to tell. And all the practical stuff that I suppose mums and parents deal with came into my mind at that stage. And then the shock and the predictive grief. You go into a grieving at that stage for what your life is not going to be.
Yeah. And you had a 9-year-old and a 2-year-old at that time.
Yeah, I was 38. Our daughter was 9. Our son was just 2. And so they were going to be two very different conversations that we were going to have. The 9-year-old was very bright, very with it, had already was on the phone to me every day going, what's the story? What's happening? Have the doctors been? And I was nervous. I was worried about what do I tell her, because we had lost my grandmother, her great grandmother, only a few months earlier to cancer. And she saw what that did to our family, how sad we were, how bereft we were. And that was the big concern that I had with using the word cancer to her at that point. But in the end, we decided to tell her, look, there were these bad cells that were taken over and that I was going to have treatment. I was going to lose my hair. And her question to my husband on the way home that night, because we told her together in the hospital room, she turned to my husband and she said, if mammy can't work, will we be able to pay the mortgage? And I don't think we had given, I don't think we had given enough understanding to the practicalities that kids think about when they're faced with a sort of a seismic shift in their life. I mean, she wasn't asking who's going to drop me to school now that mommy isn't there, or who's going to do the dinners, who's going to make my favourite dinner. She, in that moment, thought, "Who's are we going to be able to pay the mortgage if one of the two of you can't work?"
How could you have predicted that as being the first thing?
Could never have predicted it.
Okay, I want to move then from you get the diagnosis, you deal with that in whatever way you can, and then you're into, Elma, can I come back to you here? Like, it's a really busy period immediately afterwards because you're dealing with a plan now. Let's get a plan together, and you've got to follow that with all of the logistics involved.
It is. It's a very difficult period because it's a pure learning curve, you know. It's an absolute learning curve from day one. I'm not in the medical world at all. I do accountancy, and you have to learn all the new language of chemotherapy that follows with that, and operations and that follow with that, and everything. And it's a journey that you have to go on. And with a child, I suppose, he was learning it as quickly as I was. So he was picking up exactly the same things as we were. And if he had any questions, he'd keep asking the doctors. And I suppose that's one thing that he kept doing, was asking the doctors lots of questions. And logistically for us, we were up and down to Dublin. You know, we'd spend 3 weeks in Dublin, 1 week at home, and 3 weeks in Dublin and 1 week at home. And that went on for about 9 months. And then he had the operation, and we did another few months of, we did more of it after that until June the following year. He was finished chemotherapy. But it is a learning curve, and it's something that you're lucky to have the good doctors and nurses that you have with you going through it, because they are a help to you and they will get you through it. And
but all of the things you're learning, so you're learning about the health implications of the treatment. You're learning as well how to manage the rest of your life around the fact that either you or your husband aren't going to be at home for 3 weeks.
That's it as well. So we had to divide up the time, and we have a daughter as well. So she was at home at the first time that he got cancer. She was at home doing her junior cert. So she had exams to do and different things. And one of us had to be at home the whole time, and one of us had to be in Dublin the whole time. And it was hard to get around it. And when we were in Dublin, you might get a day out of the hospital. So it can, like, the expense of it as well can add up very quickly. That, you know, going around Dublin for the day, or you'd have to spend something on him, or go to the cinema, or things like that. And it's amazing how quickly the expense of it can build up so fast. Because
also, I'd imagine, Elma, you're trying to make life as pleasant as you can for your child in that circumstance.
You are. You're not trying to make it normal as you can.
Yeah.
Because he's going to have to get back into the real world as well. Okay, he was spoiled, without a doubt. His uncles, his aunts, everybody spoiled him. But and then he had to come down from that. That's another high that he was on at the time as well. And he had to come down from that when things went back to a bit of normality after that. So it is hard to keep a rein on keeping things a bit more realistic, really, because he's going to have to come back into that world again.
And then you learned so much that some of the nurses were asking you, were you a medic yourself?
That's right. By the end of it, they were asking me, was I a nurse?
Right.
But it is, you just learn the new terminology and the new drugs and whatever drugs were available at the time. And, you know, they'd talk about one drug and then you'd ask them about another drug. Maybe that was the one. But throughout it all, I'm not too sure the other people on the phone there too, or anybody else, but throughout it all, I made one decision that I wouldn't go to Dr. Google, because that's anybody's opinion. And I think you have to listen to your own doctor, and your own circumstances are different to somebody else's circumstances. And I think that's really important, because I know there was a lot of people around me, relations and different people, that were looking up Google and looking up different things, and they were saying things that never happened. So I think it's very important to listen to your own doctors and your own nurses.
Isn't it so hard to resist doing that though, Robbie? Did you go straight online? And
no, I know the rest of the family did all right now, but I didn't. I suppose I listened to the consultant, and he referred, there was actually there's a few different treatments for the cancer I had, and he actually referred me on to the other options himself, like, you know, so that at least I had a clear idea what I could do or not do. And they all ended up recommending surgery anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now there is, I know Dr. Google can be kind of, put down at times, but there's an awful lot of groups out there, like blogs of people who have gone through the same things, and they give you an idea of what's coming, what's not coming, what can happen after, what doesn't. And they're very good, like, you know, but they're not Dr. Google, you know, they're just people's personal experience.
You have to be very discerning about what you take from online. When it came to your surgery, though, did you tell them a porky pie about when you were available and when you weren't available?
Well, I did. When we had got the diagnosis, myself and Ashton said we'd go to London because that's our spot we go to. And it was the middle of November and I was in the barber's getting the moustache done, and I got a call from the hospital to say that we could take you next Friday. So it was only 3 days later. Now, when I look back on it, I should have said yes. But I said, oh, no, I'm not in the country. I can't come in then. Mm-hmm. Now, I got the operation then 5 weeks later anyway. Like, but I'm going to be honest with you, Claire. I just scared, completely scared. The bottom fell out of my world. It was like getting the diagnosis again.
That this was coming.
Yeah.
That's completely understandable, though. And then was it worse then, do you feel, having to have it done 5 weeks later? Would you have been better off having had less time to think about it?
No, because in my mind, I was going to have Christmas at home with the family. So I wanted to be able to have a Christmas in the full of my health rather than going in for the operation and then coming out and then kind of limping around the place and not being able to get around.
Yeah.
I was glad I made the decision, because in January then it was much easier, because I had the decision made in my head that that's when I was going to get it done.
And the surgery went well for you?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
They removed the tumour. Look, it's like all the cancers. It's like you could get a call tomorrow that it's back. You could get a call that it's a different thing. It's just, we need to look after ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Brenda, can I talk to you about your treatment? So you had the diagnosis, you went through the shock of hearing about it. What does the treatment involve, or what did the treatment involve?
Yeah, the cancer that I have is a blood cancer. It's called myeloma. And so my treatment involved 4 rounds of chemo given over 4 months, then a stem cell harvest where they harvest your own adult stem cells and then they freeze them. They give you some time off, you get more treatment and are built up. And then they give you what's called a stem cell transplant, which is a process that saw me in isolation in hospital for 4 weeks. It kind of prepared me for the lockdowns that we've had over the past few months. But you're in a room, you can't have your window or door open, and only a very small number of people can come into you because you are at risk of infection and of all sorts of other things. So it was a fairly harrowing treatment. I had never heard of a stem cell transplant before. I didn't know what a central line was. I mean, I was a fan of Grey's Anatomy before I was diagnosed. But I mean, I read everything that they gave me. I felt I was well prepared. But even having read everything, I had some unimaginably horrible side effects to the treatment, which neither myself or my family were properly prepared for. And I'll never forget one point. My mum-in-law came to see me, and she walked into the room and walked back out again because she didn't recognise her daughter-in-law in the bed. And it was challenging. I wasn't allowed to see the kids, although they did get to sneak Emma in once, and she just wanted to know what had happened to my eyes, etc.
Yeah.
And there was so many questions. And then my son used to ring and go, "Why don't you want to come home to me, Mammy? Why have you stayed away for so many nights?"
Oh,
and
gosh.
And that was really difficult. But at the same time, I had really good help. I had great support from my work colleagues. They had said to me, "Take all the time that you need. We're here for you." My family were brilliant. And my mum and my mum-in-law took shifts coming up from Cavan and Cork to take over kind of the day-to-day running and looking after the house and the kids. And that was tremendous, to be able to be free, to give yourself utterly 100% over to the treatment, because you really have to face it head on. You have to say, I am going to question what you're telling me, but I'm going to say yes. If you're telling me this is the best course of treatment, it's going to be horrible, but this is your only chance at being here next year, the year after, then I'm going to take it.
And are you still getting treatment now, or how are things for you?
I'm really lucky. I mean, it's a very individual disease, and I started a journey with other myeloma patients who are no longer with us. And every time somebody goes, it's very, very difficult, because you think, gosh, you know, is my turn to not be here coming around soon. They can't give you a proper prognosis because it's such an individual disease. Only 2% of people under 40 ever get the disease. I was 38 when I was diagnosed. So I don't know. I know that in the future I will have another stem cell transplant. I have stem cells waiting for me. That's the plan of action. I get seen every 3 months for bloods and a review. And that's a real comfort blanket. And I'm not on active treatment at the moment. I am in what they call the monitoring phase, and I have a great team of doctors and nurses who look after me very well in Tala. And I've had blips, and other little blips that you have can become very big blips because of your underlying issues, and they have to kind of watch the background bone marrow and bloods at all times. But I'm very lucky. I mean, I'm back to work. I'm back to work full time. I have a very active life. And there's you know, at the time, I suppose I had predictive grief, as I said earlier, for the life that I wasn't going to have, the family time that I wasn't going to have. My kids are now 23 and 16. And I bargained for the last 13 years saying, listen, I just want to get the kids through this, this and this. And then I'd go, OK, that's done. I want to redo the bargain, please, and get them through this, this and this. And I'm just so lucky to have had almost 14 years of a second chance, because none of those 14 years were ever guaranteed to me.
And it sounds,
I was diagnosed.
It sounds like you didn't take them for granted either. I'm just looking at some of the messages coming in. Tom says that he had cancer twice, and he wants to know if you've had this experience about the friends and even family that can't handle what you're going through and sadly fade into the distance. And that's understandable in a way, because some people just won't be able to deal with this. They won't be able to cope with it. Elma, do you have experience of that?
The only friends were very good to him, and I suppose, again, like, he was 12 when he was, like, you have to remember that he wasn't an adult, that they were as innocent as he was about cancer. So he was involved in a football club here in Tralee, and Cairns O'Reilly's, and he was on the football team, the under-12s, and when he was starting his first chemo, they played the under-12 county championship, which he would have played in every match up to then. And when they got to the dressing room, they'd won that day. And when they got to the dressing room, they rang him and phoned him. And, you know, that got him through that week's chemo. So the friends, they had to give him space as well to get his head around it. But it was also a bit of a learning curve for them. And in fairness, they stuck with him throughout the whole lot. We didn't have that kind of an issue where people left us or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where they left donor or anything like that. But in actual fact, they kind of stuck around and stayed more with him. But I can imagine where it would be harder for an adult, because when he was 16 and he got it again, his friends were there then for him and supported him throughout it. They were more aware then as well what he was going to be going through. But they gave him space as well, you know. When there were days when he just couldn't cope with friends and coming to the house, and they gave him space as well to get better and to be able to get the strength back.
Now, I want to talk to all of you about advice that you have for people. And Elma, for you, it was May, wasn't it, of 2013 that Donal passed away?
That's right, yeah.
You want to emphasise the importance of palliative care and the palliative care team, and urge people not to be afraid of that, because it is daunting, isn't it, for when it's first mentioned?
Oh, look, they were absolutely amazing. And when it was first mentioned, we didn't want to hear about it. You know, I had in my head that I wouldn't even meet them, and I didn't say that to Donal now, but obviously he must have picked it up from me or something. But we found it hard to get. At the time, in Tralee, there was just a palliative care day ward; it wasn't a bed unit, and we found it hard to go there. So we used to go to the children's ward in Tralee General Hospital, and Patricia Sheehan, the doctor and the nurses, they used to come up to the children's ward to meet us. And it took us a good, I'd say, 2 months to get to the to brave the palliative care unit.
Really?
Yeah, because it was another step, and it was a step that we'd no control over, and that we knew there was no more chemotherapies, we knew there was no more radiation or anything like that we could be given. But they were amazing. They were absolutely amazing. They made us feel so at home. They looked after all his needs, and not only his needs, but our needs as well, as a family, as a unit. They were patient with him, and sometimes it was hard to get blood from him, but and he'd give out to them. but they'd get a blonde-haired nurse down or doctor or something to take the blood, and he'd be happy out once the blonde-haired girl was entertaining him while he was taking it out. But there were small things that that they just picked up on, and they followed through with them, and they were so good and kind. And even when he was in his last few days here at home, if he was in any pain at all, the nurses would be out. In one occasion, the doctor came out, and they would be... He had no pain. They were able to control everything. He might have been uncomfortable for a few hours or something like that. Mm-hmm. But other than that, he was... I couldn't praise him enough. They couldn't do enough for us.
Okay. And, Robbie, on that question of advice for people who are where you were a year ago, is there anything you can say to them, something that you wish you'd known or something that you wish you'd had in your mind at that time?
I do. I thinking back now and going back on it, even with the diagnosis and telling people, I was overwhelmed by the support I got from people when they knew. And I didn't find anybody was withdrawn or wouldn't come over and have something to say. So on that, I would say, if you get the diagnosis, be open about it. Tell people. You'll be surprised at what people will say to you. Also, it's just, I know that the Irish Cancer Society have a support line, and they have people on the end of the line, the counsellors.
We'll give the details of that in a minute,
absolutely,
Robbie. Yeah.
Thank you. And just finally, what I would say to people is, and it's just, get yourself checked. Look after yourself. Please, please get checked, no matter what it is.
Take the first step.
Yeah.
Brenda, for you, and lots of people are thanking you all, by the way, for doing this, but what's your advice, or do you have any for people? Can you advise somebody before this hits them?
I think you can, but I think the main thing is that people would be kind to themselves, to take the news at their own pace, to write things down, to be honest with their kids in an age-appropriate way. And in the middle of all of this, don't forget that you know, to have fun, to kind of take pleasure in things. It's very hard to do that when you feel I should be all about the cancer and I shouldn't be laughing. And people mean well. I mean, one of my family members told me I had a very lovely small head when she saw me bald for the first time. Now, I mean, like, I laughed, but I mean, you have to understand, people are coming to you and coming to this diagnosis from a very difficult place. I had an aunt in England who sent my mother some miracle powder that helps you have a child. I don't know how that was helpful to me when I was going through cancer, but people are kind. People have your best intentions at heart. I also think that it's important that if you are not able to talk to people, that you get that message out there. I mean, I went through a phase of the treatment when I was in high intensity of the treatment, where I couldn't speak. I kind of lost the ability and the energy to put words together. So texting became important. And I felt bad the first couple of times that I let voice calls go to voice message. But you need to kind of protect yourself in the intense phase of treatment, and don't be afraid that you're going to offend people. People won't be offended, because they understand that you are going through hell on earth in many ways. And I'd also say to people, like, to have faith, that, you know, I know all won't be well in all cases, as Elma has said, but I think you have to have faith in the time that you have to be and to get over the other side of initial treatment. And I also agree with Robbie and get checked. My daughter actually, about 2 years after the diagnosis and the intense treatment, got upset one day, and I picked her up from school and I said, right, we're staying in the car and we're having this conversation. What's wrong? And she made me make a promise to her. She would have been 11 at that stage, that if I was told that my cancer or my outcome or my prognosis was hopeless, that I would tell her the moment that I knew, because she said there was things that she would want to do with me and for me before I died. And that was probably one of the hardest things I've ever heard. But it's important to give your kids that space to say those things and for you to hear those.
OK, well, look, I know you've provided an invaluable service to people. And just one of the messages here is, please thank the three courageous people this morning. They've given me a big lift on a stressful day post-scan. So thank you all, says that listener. And there are many more there as well. So, Robbie, continued good health to you. Brenda, the same to you. Thank you very much for being with us. And Emma, we remember remember Donal today and we remember his charity, Donal Live Life, which I know is working away there in the background. And for people who would like to get in touch for support, the Irish Cancer Society helpline is 1800 200 700 or you can email supportline@irishcancer.ie for counselling services for anyone who's affected by cancer who needs someone to talk to, and that can include yourself or your family members or your children. Thank you all very much indeed.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.